We'll proceed now in the last matter on this afternoon's calendar, People v. Manuel Alex Trujillo, and we will hear first from Mr. Michael Kresser.
Thank you, Chief Justice George, and good afternoon to all members of the court. In the present case, there was a court trial at which the trial judge tried two prior conviction allegations, strike prior allegations. At the conclusion of that trial, the judge found one was true as a strike, the other was not a strike. The trial judge then proceeded to sentence my client to 7 years, doubling the midterm 3 years for the felony assault offense, of which the jury had convicted him, and enhanced it by 1 year for a prior prison term. The people have appealed the sentence and have sought a determination that would reverse the sentence and reverse the not true finding on the prior serious strike prior allegation.
Now, the people's right to appeal, of course, is one that's defined by statute, and 1238 of the Penal Code provides in part that the people may appeal from the imposition of an unlawful sentence. So the question here, correct, I gather, that faces us is whether it is or is not an unlawful sentence to, in effect, rule that a prior conviction did not constitute a serious felony and therefore was not a strike within the three strikes law. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and the language that you referred to is contained in subdivision A10 of section 1238. And that was the basis on which the Court of Appeal determined that there was a statutory right to appeal. However, I think if you, if the Court looks at the specific language of that statute and looks at the legislative history of not only that statute, but also the another subdivision that the people rely on, subdivision A8, and if the Court also applies its customary policy of not construing a statute in a way that would create grave constitutional issues, that the court should find that there is no statutory right to appeal.
What is the constitutional issue that we should avoid reaching by construction? And I certainly agree with you that that is a fundamental canon of statutory construction, to avoid serious constitutional issues if possible through the construction of a statute. What is that constitutional issue that you would have us avoid or evade under this interpretation that you urge upon us?
The constitutional issues that would arise arise both under the Sixth Amendment and state constitutional jury trial guarantees, and also the double jeopardy provisions of both the federal and state constitutions. These would arise because the jury trial right here, we're talking about our client, under the prior decision of this court, had no right to have a jury determine the truth of this prior conviction allegation, other than for the very limited role that this court has said that it has under the statutory law of the state. Also, of course, any time that the people are permitted to appeal a sentence, the question of double jeopardy arises. Now, it is true that this court has confronted that issue in the past, in the Monge case, and was one which went on to the U.S. Supreme Court and was affirmed. And so, of course, the people's position is that, well, there is no constitutional issue there. It's all been settled. However, I think that to take that position ignores the decisional law from the U.S. Supreme Court that has occurred since the Monge decision was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. It ignores the fact that the Apprendi decision came out and limited the reach of Amar Mendoza-Torres very severely, virtually to its facts, which in Amar Mendoza-Torres included the fact that the defendant there never challenged the truth of the prior conviction allegation in that case. And in our particular case, we have this problem where there must be fact-finding beyond the elements of the offense of which my client was convicted.
Well, with respect to the double jeopardy issue that you just articulated, in response to the question by the Chief Justice, Would that mean that this court would have to overrule its decision in Monjuan and just disregard the United States Supreme Court's decision in Monjuan?
I don't think that's absolutely necessary for the court to do that. I have, of course, invited the court to revisit its decision in Monge on the state constitutional issue and have set forth in the briefs, I think, some very cogent criticisms of that decision that have been put forth. However, I think it's just being realistic at this point for this court to realize that this is an area of law that is in extreme flux. And we find ourselves in a very unfortunate situation in which we know that a majority of the current Supreme Court does not adhere to the principle that animated the Monge and Armendariz-Torres decisions. We know that by virtue of Justice Thomas's concurrences in Apprendi and, again, more recently in the Shepherd case.
And it's your view that taking a look at the statute in question pertaining to appealability, that the people have no right to appeal here?
Yes. After a trial of a prior conviction allegation, there is no right for the people to appeal an adverse decision on the merits.
But then, how would you get around the plain language of subdivision A-10 of Penal Code Section 1238 that expressly says that the people can indeed appeal from an order imposing an unlawful sentence, and presumably the argument on the other side, the opposing side, the people's side, the AG side is, well, if in this particular case the trial court did not was wrong in imposing or in ruling that the conviction at issue was not a strike, then, according to the people, the court imposed an unlawful sentence. And getting back to the plain language that I just quoted to you, it seems that at first glance the people do have merit to the argument that, yes, they do have a right to appeal.
Well, the subdivision 810, I think there's some historical perspective that needs to be looked at, too. That subdivision passed back in 1985. At that time, according to my research, there had never been any prosecutorial attempt to ever appeal from a not true finding on a prior conviction allegation. But even putting that to aside, that it had never even been attempted at that time, from any evidence that I've seen, you have to look, of course, at the statutory language. And they don't say a sentence that is unlawful in any respect can be appealed. Rather, they give a definition and narrow that phrase, unlawful sentence. And they say, as used in this paragraph, unlawful sentence means the imposition of a sentence not authorized by law or the imposition of a sentence based upon an unlawful order of the court which strikes or otherwise modifies the effect of an enhancement or prior conviction. Now, if we look at the sentence my client received, received a sentence that is authorized by the Penal Code. He got the midterm for the Section 245 A1 violation. It was doubled as required by the three strikes law from the one prior strike conviction allegation that was found true by the court.
And what was that prior conviction?
The other one was a Section 245 violation. The prior conviction allegation, there were two of them, the one 245 A1 prior found true. The second one was...
Leaving aside the blah, 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 A1, how about putting it in plain English?
Assault with a deadly weapon, or with force... assault with a deadly weapon.
And your view is that the prior conviction at issue would have qualified as a strike if there had been the additional deadly weapon, but standing alone, without the finding of use of a deadly weapon, according to your argument, it cannot be a strike.
Yes, because the one that was found not true was a infliction of corporal injury on a spouse or cohabitant. And that conviction originated when the people charged my client both with a charge of assault with a deadly weapon and with corporal injury with a personal use clause. However, a plea bargain was entered into in which the people dismissed the assault with a deadly weapon charge, dismissed the personal use of a weapon allegation, and my client pled simply to a violation of Section 273.5, the infliction of corporal injury.
Well, don't the cases say, I think in particular Blackburn, that notwithstanding a dismissal, say pursuant to a plea bargain, that the court can consider whether a weapon was used in the underlying prior conviction?
Blackburn does say that, Your Honor. It's our position that Blackburn is wrongly decided. For several reasons. First off, you have the situation that the U.S. Supreme Court addressed in its decisions in Taylor, and then the dissenters in Shepard again addressed, which is basically what we're trying to do here is find out what facts were really adjudicated in this prior proceeding. And we're going to limit that. The Supreme Court has taken a much more limited approach to this, obviously, than many California state decisions have taken. But they have severely limited the record of conviction that can be considered in the later trial of a prior conviction allegation.
Well, in Blackburn, it was.
Go ahead if you.
Well, in Blackburn, it was the preliminary hearing transcript.
That's correct.
And the same in Reed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And here it's an admission and a probation officer's report.
It's an admission and a probation
report. Do we have to disapprove of a Blackburn or Reed in order to reach a result that's favorable to you in this case?
Yes, I believe you do. I believe
Why
you
is
Well,
that?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, when we look at, we kind of move from the is there a right to appeal to was there error committed questions here, and I believe that when you look at the finding of the trial judge, I don't believe that it's necessarily infected with the legal error that the people see and which the Court of Appeal saw. They said, well, precluded consideration of this admission in the probation report. But if you look at the record of the trial, this was admitted. The court considered it. It simply wasn't persuaded by it, and it made a not true finding. So I don't necessarily think. I think it can be sustained on that basis, on the basis that we have a true finding here in which the court simply was not convinced of the truth of the allegation beyond a reasonable doubt, as it has to be under
Mr.
our special.
Taking you back to your constitutional argument,
yes.
And you did address one of two, namely the double jeopardy one, but I believe
yes.
You also had a jury trial, right?
Yes.
And I wonder, in terms of your apparent invocation of Apprendi and perhaps Booker and Blakely, what about the fact that that line of cases reserves an exception for prior convictions? And, of course, that's the kind of enhancement that we have
yes.
here.
Yes.
And I know that may be the subject of oral argument a week from tomorrow in the Cunningham versus California
yes.
case in the U.S. Supreme Court. But
isn't
that exception still viable? And why should those constitutional considerations apply to this particular type of enhancement, a prior conviction enhancement?
Because in our particular case, we're not looking at a prior conviction where the facts that are established, the elements of that prior conviction, the trier fact has to go beyond that. If we just look at the conviction, it's a 273.5 conviction. It does not qualify as a serious felony. You have to have the additional finding that there was a personal use of a weapon. That originally was alleged, but it was dismissed. And so it's not part of the judgment because it doesn't match up with the elements. And so there has to be additional fact-finding. Now, when the Supreme Court was confronted with the exact same situation in Shepard, it says, we're not going to authorize going beyond these very strict limits because this is too much like Apprendi and not enough like Almendarez-Torres. We're not talking about something that's clearly within Almendarez-Torres anymore when you're talking about a situation such as our case, where it's not like a kidnapping, which is per se a serious felony. It's not on that list of per se felonies. 273.5 is not. You need the additional factual determination that my client personally used a weapon, something was originally alleged but was dismissed as part of the plea bargain.
Did he concede that statement to the probation officer that he had used a knife?
Yes, there is a statement in the probation report in which the probation officer says he admitted that I used a knife.
Would it be proper to consider?
Pardon me?
Would it be proper to consider that probation report?
Certainly under federal law, it would not be. If we were in a federal court going under the Armed Career Criminal Act, because in Shepard they say we're not going to look at things like allegations and complaints. We're going to strictly limit this. We're going to look at facts that were necessarily found at the time of the prior conviction.
That's a federal procedure. That's not a federal constitutional mandate.
They did not say that this was a matter of Sixth Amendment law. What they did say is we will not take the contrary approach because to do so would create serious constitutional issues. And so they're saying we're not going to go into that quagmire. And I would suggest to the court that that is a wise and prudent course that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken and one that this court should emulate.
Are you suggesting that cases such as Guerrero, which allow you to examine the record of conviction to clarify an ambiguity regarding the conviction, that that's no longer good law?
Well, Guerrero, I think if you limit it strictly to the holding, is quite consistent with both Taylor and Shepard, because basically what Guerrero said is you can look at the complaint, and which had not, under this court's prior decisional law, it was a strictly an elements in the abstract type of situation in Alfaro. This court overruled its prior decision in Alfaro and said, okay, we're going to let you look at the complaint. And in that case, the complaint alleged a residential burglary. But they did say in footnote one, they said, okay, we realize that we're not going to totally define the record of conviction here, and we realize that in particular cases, operation of the rule we have just enunciated may lead to constitutional violations, but we're not going to anticipate those at this time. So I don't think it's at all inconsistent with Guerrero to say at this point we are going to follow the lead of the U.S. Supreme Court, avoid these constitutional difficult issues, and we're going to limit the scope of the record of conviction that can be considered.
Counsel, in this case...
As
I understand it, in this case, the defendant admitted to the probation officer.
That's what the probation officer said.
A deadly weapon was used. Is that correct?
Yes.
And at the time of sentencing, was he given the opportunity to make any additions or corrections to the probation report?
We don't really know because the sentencing hearing was never put into evidence in the case.
I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The sentencing hearing was never introduced. A transcript of the sentencing hearing was never introduced into evidence.
But that is provided for under the law that the defendant does have the opportunity to make any corrections to a probation report.
He certainly can object and ask the court to correct anything that's in there, yes.
So, are we to assume that corrections were attempted or not attempted, or what are we to assume?
I don't think we can assume anything, because we have no adequate record on which to base...
In any event, the...
we're in the realm of speculation.
In any event, the probation report... was not changed. In other words, it did contain the defendant's admission that he did use a knife. Why isn't that reliable? I mean, how much more reliable could something be than if it's in the probation report, the defendant has the opportunity to contest it? Let's assume for the sake of argument he doesn't contest it and acquiesces in it, and is then sentenced. Why isn't that a reliable fact in the record of conviction?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two questions here. Number one, is it a reliable fact? And number two, is it really part of the conviction, if you will? In other words, are these facts, are we expanding the scope of the fact-finding beyond what was actually determined by the court in the proceedings that resulted in the prior conviction, or are we sticking with that? Number two, the question is, if we start going outside and looking at other things, is this particular thing reliable? And I think that is a determination that has to be made by a finder of fact. I mean, we really usually leave that to a trier of fact. In this case, I think you can look at it and say, well, wait a minute. The victim, when she gave her statement, if you're going to look at the whole probationary report, the victim's statement doesn't say anything about being assaulted with a knife. She's only talking about being pushed and shoved and kicked. She doesn't say anything about that. We look at his statement. He says, hey, I was really intoxicated. I'd been drinking Cisco's all day long. So we're talking about an extrajudicial statement by somebody who was intoxicated at the time of the events that he is now purporting to relate. Is that reliable? I think some fact finders would find it reliable. Some fact finders applying the beyond a reasonable doubt standard might say, no, this just doesn't make it for me. I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it. And particularly if I look at the willingness of the prosecution to dismiss, they had made the factual allegation. And then we go to the point raised in Justice O'Connor's dissent in Shepherd, where she poses the issue is, what did the defendant understand he was admitting to at the time he made the plea? Could there be any misunderstanding? And she said, well, if there is charge bargaining, and then the defendant might not realize that he is admitting that he used a knife here for purposes of defining what this conviction is. See, there was... So I would say, first of all, it's the reliability is of any piece of evidence really is usually committed to a trier of fact. And I would argue here that the trier of fact didn't find it particularly reliable.
And so we're looking... the trial court was looking back 10 years to a 1991 conviction where the defendant was charged with spousal battery and assault with a deadly weapon. The deadly weapon charge was dismissed and the weapon enhancement to the spousal battery was dismissed.
Correct.
10 years before this instant case.
In a factual scenario where there were both, where there was assaultive conduct described of a non-weapons use variety and a weapons use variety. So we kind of got a mixed bag of facts here. If we're all going to just open it all up and look at all the facts we can glean from probation reports and police reports and everything else, I mean, that's what our situation is. So I think any reasonable person, when the district attorney says, okay, we'll dismiss this charge of assault with a deadly weapon with a knife, we will dismiss the allegation that you personally used a dangerous deadly weapon to wit a knife, and you will be pleading to simply inflicting corporal injury on your spouse, I don't think a reasonable defendant is going to think, gee, I just admitted that I used a knife.
Now, mistakenly or not, is the perhaps the defendant and maybe the attorneys left with the impression that he didn't plead to a strikeable prior?
Once again, it's really outside of the record. I mean, we don't really know yay or nay on that issue.
Why is it permissible to consider, for instance, a preliminary hearing transcript or even an appellate opinion, but not a probation report?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that, in fact, under Taylor and Shepherd, it's not permissible to look at a preliminary transcript, nor is it permissible to look at an appellate opinion. If you look at the opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Shepherd case, it is very specific. Plea colloquy, in the plea context, you can look at the plea colloquy, and you can look at any factual findings made by a judge to which the defendant assented. That's it.
Well, what if the defendant made a statement at a preliminary hearing, and after all, you have the procedural rights, confrontation, cross-examination, all of that? Wouldn't a fallback position be that if you could consider a preliminary hearing transcript, it's distinguishable from a probation officer's report, which doesn't involve the same procedural context?
Well, I think that would create a stronger case for admission because you would have your full panoply of protections, if you will, representation by counsel at the preliminary hearing. Of course, I think as we all realize, the number of cases in which a defendant testifies at the preliminary hearing is minuscule, to say the least.
But actually, from the standpoint of clarifying the record, at least based on my experience, prelims generally the prosecution puts on whatever it wants to put on and gets the defendant held to answer. Whereas when you're talking about a probation report, that probation report, as I recall, there's specific requirements where the defendant is entitled to a copy of it so many days in advance, can contest any inaccuracy in that, can have a hearing to determine the factual accuracy of that probation report.
That's correct.
And in a sense, at least the way I look at it, there's a lot more reliability in the accuracy of a probation report that comes in at the tail end of all the investigation, in contrast to a preliminary hearing transcript.
Well, you may respond, but your time is otherwise up.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. One thing you don't have at a probation interview generally is the protection of the advice of your counsel. Something you have at a preliminary examination, you have at your plea, but you don't have that at the time of your probation interview. I think the courts have held you have no right to have counsel present for that interview, or you have no right to be told you have a right to have counsel there, or any kind of right to remain silent. So I think that's one area where you can say the procedural protections are much less in this probation context than they would be in either the plea or the preliminary examination.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Presser. We'll hear now from Mr. McCarroll.
May it please the Court. The reasons that the trial court stated on the record for finding that this prior conviction was not a strike, both of those reasons were legally erroneous.
And they result- that were to be the case, would that be binding on us? Sometimes it's said in the context of familiar rules of appellate review that a decision right in conclusion will not be set aside because the reasons given for it were wrong. So would your position be that there is no justifiable basis for the trial court's ruling, or just that because the trial court gave the wrong reason, one could not uphold that ruling?
Our position is there is no justifiable reason, regardless of what the court said on the record or any sort of silent rationale that it might have secretly harbored as to this finding. Now, the defendant offered three possible explanations, none of which were advanced in the trial court, none of which the trial court actually relied on. One of them was that evidence of an evidentiary admission should be viewed with caution. Well, in this case, the evidence of the admission came from a detached probation officer who has no interest to report the statement falsely. There's no suggestion that this statement was so complex that somehow the probation officer wouldn't be able to report it accurately, or that there'd be any other sort of error in transmitting this statement to the court.
What's the consequence, if any, of the people's having entered into a plea bargain or case settlement whereby it dismissed the allegation that the defendant used a deadly or dangerous weapon and committed assault with a deadly weapon?
From an evidentiary standpoint, there is no consequence whatsoever. This was a domestic violence case, and this being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I think it's worth noting that in many domestic violence cases, the victim pleads with the prosecutor not to proceed with the case, not because there's a lack of evidence, but for some other reason that the victim often doesn't want to see the defendant go to prison or to jail or to otherwise be away from the family.
Well, without getting into a huge analysis of what month it is, isn't it so that when the people charge a number of allegations, basically in the alternative, it is not at all uncommon for there to be an agreement that you'll plead to one, we'll dismiss the other, and we'll all go home? And that it may be tempting to read the tea leaves in terms of what it really means and what they could prove and what they didn't, but the reality is they dismissed one, he fled to the other, and that's what we're stuck with.
Yes, and that the prosecutor wouldn't have done that based on the quantum or quality of the evidence.
Well, the prosecution may have done it for any number of reasons, but it is what it is.
That's correct. And under Section 1192.7a, the prosecutor was free to enter into this bargain without restriction because it was at the complaint stage, not at the information or indictment stage. Now, the fact that the prosecutor did enter into a plea agreement, though, also, from a constitutional perspective, wouldn't somehow induce the defendant to think that the plea agreement actually operated as some sort of future immunity agreement from the three strikes law. When the defendant entered into this agreement, it was already the law, as this court recognized in Harvey, that the dismissal of a transactionally related enhancement does not bar the consideration of the facts underlying that enhancement for sentencing purposes at the current trial. Subsequent cases explain that there's nothing to suggest that such a bar would exist in future cases. So since a future trial court could consider the facts underlying this enhancement for the imposition of an upper term, the question then becomes, would there be any reason for the defendant to think that a different rule would apply in three strikes cases?
Would you have to advise the defendant that although this is being dropped for purposes of this case, it might be used against you in a future case to greatly enhance your punishment should you reoffend?
No. Under Boykin and Tall, the trial court is only required to advise of the direct primary results of the plea. Whether or not any fact will result in a future enhancement in a future case is a secondary and a collateral consequence of the plea.
Even if it
could result in a strike. And part of the reason for that is that the three strikes law, what crimes are per se strikes, is constantly changing. It'd be impossible to advise a defendant that a particular offense will be a strike or will not be a strike in the future.
And whether it involves a potential life sentence wouldn't make any difference in terms of the requirement to advise them.
That's correct. Because a prior conviction that results in a defendant being a second striker one day can result in him being a third striker the next. So the trial court would have no idea whether or not a particular fact may someday lead to a life sentence. In fact, the trial court should hold out hope that it will never result in a life sentence, that the defendant will be rehabilitated and will not become a recidivist subject to the three strikes law. But returning first to the question of whether or not the people could even appeal this issue in the first place, whether or not this court could even have jurisdiction, I'd like to point out the defendant argued or relied on this concept of constitutional doubt as being a canon of statutory construction. I think a primary element of construction, notwithstanding the plain language of the statute, is whether or not an interpretation would lead to absurd results. Now, the defendant's argument, essentially, is that as long as the trial court phrases the ruling as being that the allegation is not true, the people would have no remedy. So suppose that a trial court says that a particular defendant has a prior conviction for murder. And then suppose that the trial court, perhaps harboring some sort of animus against the operation of the three strikes law, says, well, the allegation is not true because murder is not a strike. The prosecutor would obviously object and point out that murder is, in fact, the first on the list of serious felonies, first on the list of violent felonies. But under the defendant's interpretation, the people could not appeal this absolutely absurd ruling because...
clearly be an error of law, not a question of fact, no matter what the trial court calls it.
Well, yes, but that's the defendant's interpretation of the statute, that so long as it's phrased as not true, that's all that matters.
Knock down that straw man.
Yes.
Perhaps we could move on to one that you might really want to engage in here. What would be wrong with this analysis? The people don't have a right to appeal because the trial court really did make an evidentiary error. The trial court did not admit an item of evidence. And as a result of its decision not to admit that item of evidence, it found there wasn't sufficient evidence for the people to discharge their burden. Therefore, they couldn't prove the allegation. Wouldn't we ordinarily say that an evidentiary ruling is not appealable?
Not under subdivision A10. Because it would be... Once the evidence is so central to the question that the three strikes law asks, what did the defendant do in committing the prior offense? That is so central that the ruling, that the evidentiary ruling in that case would in fact be a finding that would strike or otherwise modify the effect of the prior conviction having already been found by the court. Essentially, in conducting the analysis, the court conducts a two-step inquiry, the first step having been satisfied. It refuses to look at evidence at the second step. That can, in fact, modify the effect of that prior conviction.
But the error under this analysis, the error would be labeled not a refusal to consider admissible offense. It's coming in, but I'm just not going to pay any attention to it. The error is, as a matter of law, this is inadmissible. I'm making an evidentiary ruling, says the trial court, and I find that this evidence is inadmissible. Therefore, there's not enough evidence in the record for you, Mr. Prosecutor, to discharge your burden. Ordinarily, we don't allow the people to appeal from strict evidentiary ruling errors. You're not arguing that that should be the rule unless the evidence is really, really important.
Most of the cases, in fact, to my knowledge, all of the cases involving the prohibition on appealing evidentiary errors come in the context of the underlying trial of guilt on the substantive count, as opposed to prior convictions. So a ruling that the people can't complain about an evidentiary ruling that led to an acquittal, there's no problem with barring the people from that, because since it was an acquittal, double jeopardy would prohibit the people from retrying the case, and there's no problem in barring the people from taking an appeal when we can't have a retrial. But under Monge 1 and Monge 2, when there's a prior conviction, we can have a retrial, regardless of whether or not the retrial will require some sort of additional evidentiary findings. Because Monge 1 and Monge 2 involved findings that the quantum of evidence that the people offered was insufficient as a matter of law. Now, insufficiency of the evidence is the quintessential double jeopardy bar, absent, of course, a not guilty verdict, which would be the first. The second would be insufficient evidence. So if we can retry a prior conviction allegation under Monge 1 and Monge 2 under the Double Jeopardy Clause, there's no reason to bar the people from having the right to do so.
Thank you.
What impact would this?
Are you sure?
Pertaining to the applicability, I presume you urge this court to look at the particular language in A10 of the particular law at issue, which talks about the people having a right to appeal an unlawful sentence. And as I understand your argument, in this case, the trial court ruled that the prior conviction pertaining to infliction of bodily injury was, according to the trial court, not a strike. The people disagreed. The people said, of course it was and is a strike, and you, trial court, erred. And this means that instead of the 7 years to which you, the trial court, sentenced the defendant, we, the people, take the view that the defendant should have been sentenced to the life term for the prior strike. And your view is that this, at its core, is, based upon your argument, an unlawful sentence, and therefore the people do fit within the exact language of A10 of 1238 of the Penal Code that says, yes, the people do have a right to appeal from an unlawful sentence.
That's correct. Particularly in this case, where the trial court's express statements of reasons on the record both involved purely questions of law. On the one hand, it said, there was nothing in the elements of what the defendant pleaded to, and therefore I cannot consider. Well, that's contrary to what this court has said, that the trial court, in conducting this analysis, may consider the entire record of the conviction, not just the elements.
Ah, so, now we're getting to what I think is the more difficult issue. Here, all we have is a statement in the probation report where the defendant tells the probation officer, I did use a knife. And, of course, the people argue to this court that was quite proper. But what about the counter-arguments? Yes, we've heard observations about the reliability of the probation report, but I presume a counter-argument can be made that, well, the probation report is made after the fact of conviction. When the formal constraints of a court proceeding are behind the defendant, and so according to that particular argument, in talking to the probation officer, the defendant can with impunity make whatever statements he or she desires to make, and therefore, according to that counter-argument, reliability just is not a great factor in that particular circumstance.
That was the same argument that the defendant raised, that essentially a defendant doesn't have an incentive to rebut erroneous information in a probation report. The problem with that argument, though, is that the trial court always has the ability to reject a plea agreement. And in fact, a plea agreement is like a three-party contract. And the trial court, in accepting the plea originally, is the party with the least amount of information, especially if there hasn't been a preliminary hearing. The trial court relies on the contents of the probation report to figure out what actually was going on. Now, in this case, the probation officer, after discovering the true facts as the defendant described it, recommended that the court not accept this agreement because the sentence was so low compared to the facts that the defendant described. Once the defendant read that statement in the report, he had an incentive to rebut that statement if it was erroneous. But there's no evidence that he did rebut that statement. Now, the defendant argues, well, there's sort of an absence of evidence in this case. There's no evidence that he did have, that he was presented with a probation report, that he did actually have the opportunity to rebut it. Well, those are all requirements of the statute, and we presume that the official duties required by the statute have been regularly performed. So in the absence of affirmative evidence, we have to assume that the probation report, or that the probation officer discharged his duties properly, and that the court discharged its duties properly in giving the defendant an opportunity to rebut the report. And if he did rebut the report and failed to mention it in the current proceedings, he's certainly free to on retrial.
How would this work in the case of a foreign conviction, a conviction in another state? Let's assume that the state of the prior conviction had a burglary statute that didn't distinguish between burglary of a home and burglary of some other type of structure. And he comes to California and commits a crime in California, and the prosecution wants to prove that the prior, under California law, would be a first-degree burglary of a home, and introduces the probation report where the defendant admits that the burglary was of a home as opposed to a commercial structure or something else. Now, if I follow opposing counsel's argument, the prosecution would be precluded from establishing the prior as a first-degree burglary in California. Is that correct?
Yes, that the probation reports from foreign states, under the defendant's argument, is no more reliable than a probation report from California. And I think we'd agree, at least, that in order for any sort of evidence of this kind to be introduced to the trial court, it at least has to satisfy the hearsay rule. And so for probation reports, it'll still have to get over the hurdle imposed by 1280. And I'm not at all sure that the people can say that probation reports in every other state qualify under 1280. The people can say that they do qualify in California, that the protections we provide are sufficient to admit this type of report, provided that it was generated by a California probation officer discharging his duties under California law. And we'll leave it to other cases to resolve the question for other jurisdictions. And it's the different treatment that different jurisdictions have regarding plea agreements, which also makes Shepard a really unworkable system in California. One of the in Shepard, the court limited the various sorts of records that a federal court applying a federal statute could look to. And one of them, the defendant has offered a number of new authorities in the last few days, in which the courts always seem to quote the holding in the first paragraph, but ignore the holding in the final paragraph of the opinion. And that paragraph refers to the fact that a federal court may look to the transcript of the colloquy between the judge and the defendant in which the factual basis for the plea was confirmed by the defendant or to some comparable judicial record.
Now, why is a probation officer's report comparable? Because, as we stated, I think in the McGee case, we talked about proceedings that underlie the conviction, and, of course, a statement made after the case is over with to a probation officer arguably doesn't underlie the conviction the way a plea colloquy might or the way some testimony given under oath with cross-examination and representation by counsel that was before the jury that rendered the conviction or before the court in the bench trial might provide a basis. So how does it meet that second standard?
The fact that in plea cases a conviction is actually not final until the court accepts the plea at the end of the sentencing proceeding. The court can withdraw its acceptance at any time up to that point. In other words, it's not over until it's over.
But even if it isn't, it still is the basis upon which the conviction is found, is made. Whereas the probation officer's report and the statements in it seem to me to be a basis upon which a sentence is imposed, but not upon which the conviction, that is the determination of guilt or innocence, is made. Isn't that a distinction?
Well, no. To butcher an analogy, this court has analogized plea agreements to regular contracts. The sentencing phase and the probation report are like escrow. The court has entered into this initial agreement to accept the plea, but it is required to find that there is a factual basis for the plea. If the contents of the probation report lead the court to believe that there is not a factual basis for the plea, the court should withdraw its approval of the conviction, and the conviction will then, therefore, be set aside.
Well, to follow your contractual analogy, that's more or less a condition subsequent, isn't it? I mean, there is an agreement, and you're saying the court can get out of the agreement, but it is, in the absence of setting something aside, a sufficient basis for a finding of guilt, either through the plea colloquy or through the evidence presented at trial, unlike, it seems to me, a probation officer's report, where the matters in that report go to the determination of the appropriate sentence. Well, to me, I see a distinction, but apparently you do not.
It is certainly true that the primary role of the probation report is to aid the court in sentencing. But because of the court's ability to withdraw its acceptance of the plea agreement and therefore to essentially nullify the effect of the plea, that the plea isn't final until the end of the sentencing hearing, and that because the probation report is part of the record leading up to that occurrence, it is part of the record of conviction.
The probation report, though, and I think listened correctly, I think there is merit to the Chief Justice's observation distinguishing the probation report. I think that the Chief Justice pointed out, I hope I've got it right, that the probation report doesn't go to the nature of the crime that led to the plea or the conviction. And I think the Chief pointed out the probation report is naturally useful in sentencing, but and I see a difference between the two, as the discussion between the bench and counsel has indicated. The probation report is prepared after the plea or after the conviction, and as such, it's not part and parcel of the proceedings that determine the crime that led to the conviction or the plea. I think that's a hurdle that at least I see in...
I guess the issue would be, let's suppose that there's a, that the defendant tells the probation officer, my attorney advised me that the sentence was going to be X number of years. And the trial court, upon reading that, knows that that's incorrect. The question then is, does that statement have any tendency to affect the validity of the plea, which has already been entered? Now, if the conviction was final, the second the defendant said, I plead guilty, and the court accepted it originally, then any statement that the defendant makes in the probation report presumably would have absolutely no impact on whether or not the plea was valid. Well, it's the people's position that that's not the case, that the court is required to look at the defendant's statements in the probation report, not only for purposes of sentencing, but if they evince some sort of defect in the conviction, that the court has to take notice of that.
Let me flip that around the other way. Let's just say that there was some evidence of use of a knife, and in the probation officer's report, there is a set of statements perhaps made by not just the defendant, but three or four eyewitnesses saying, oh, well, I can tell you for sure there was no knife at all. I had a great view of what took place, and sure, he committed this crime, but there was no knife. There was nothing in his hands. Would a trial court be justified in striking an enhancement on that basis? Would it have to, and could that be appealed?
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to clarify that. In your hypothetical, did the defendant say that there was knife use and he was...
Let's say there was evidence at the trial, but then all of a sudden at the probation officer's report, that stage, there's all sorts of uncontradicted evidence that there never was a knife. Could a trial court be justified in striking an enhancement that it had found or that a jury had found to be true because of this material in the probation officer's report, which you feel a trial judge properly can consider after the determination of guilt and before imposition of sentence? Does it work both ways?
Well, regardless of which way it works, it has to satisfy the hearsay rule. And the statements from third-party witnesses that are contained in probation reports, those have an independent hearsay problem that doesn't exist with the defendant's statement.
Well, sometimes that can be overcome depending upon the source. Let's say somebody comes up with some spontaneous declarations or whatever. Let's just assume that there is no hearsay problem. Does it work both ways? Can you look at that report and then use that to strike the strike?
Well, it can look at the report and it can make the determination that it was not true based on that report. And when you're using the term strike, I'm presuming that's in the Romero context, that'd be equally applicable.
Let's say a jury had found an enhancement, let's say, of knife use. Could the trial judge strike that because of this other material in the probation report? Does it work both ways, in other words?
The court could consider it, and I think in a case like that, the people would have an excellent argument that it would have been an abuse of discretion, that it wouldn't have been supported by substantial evidence, because on the one hand, there was sworn testimony at trial and a conclusive finding by the jury, and on the other hand, there were unsworn statements to a probation officer in which the, you know, it depends on whether or not also those witnesses were called to testify at the sentencing hearing.
But it doesn't bother you that here the defendant's statement was unsworn to the probation officer?
No, because it was an admission, and because the defendant had a full opportunity to contest that with the aid of counsel at his sentencing hearing. And there's no evidence that he did ever dispute that this statement was truthful. In fact, there's no evidence that even in the current proceedings he has ever disputed that this statement was truthful. It's just a new argument which defendant has raised on appeal as a possible alternate ground that the trial court might have raised sua sponte and relied on secretly.
It sounds to me is that you're arguing that the rule ought to be that the courts should be able to look at a particular probation report and determine whether or not that report is admissible under general rules of evidence.
That's correct.
And in this case, it's admissible because it's an admission against interest.
Yes, the statement is admissible because it's against interest, and the probation report is admissible under 12A.
And of course, in the preparation of a probation report, the probation officer is duty-bound, is he not, to set forth the facts and circumstances of the crime?
He is. And it is presumed that that official duty is regularly performed, and there's no evidence in this record that the probation officer did anything else.
Well, here we have a fairly straightforward case, an admission or alleged admission by a defendant. I mean, as the Chief pointed out, are oftentimes statements taken from multiple witnesses, and isn't it too much to ask the trial court to sort of sift through all that and try to figure out what really happened in a probation report without seeing the witnesses testifying in court?
Well, if the defendant admitted in this case that he stabbed someone with a knife, it's probably unlikely that there's a witness available who's going to contradict
him. There's no ambiguity about that.
Correct. And, again, each of the other witnesses would have to have their own hearsay exception.
Sure.
And to the extent that there were exonerating circumstances or exonerating statements made in the probation report, they were probably introduced at trial. And the jury probably already considered them in finding that the defendant was guilty.
Well, there would be different if somebody else came up other than the defendant with an observation that a knife was used here. Would the people's position be the same if that statement in the probation officer's report came from somebody who didn't testify at trial but who said the same thing that the defendant said? Would your position be any different?
Well, for instance, the victim in this case said that the defendant used a knife. We're not arguing that the trial court can rely on that.
There was no trial on the prior conviction. He pled. So there were no witnesses testifying. We're relying on the probation report.
Well, that's correct. There were no witnesses because of the plea. Right. But that being said, no matter how favorable these other witnesses may have been to the people, we're not asking the trial court to consider them unless they meet the hearsay exception.
Well, why not rely on the arrest reports, then, crime reports?
Excuse me?
Why not rely on crime reports or arrest reports for statements of witnesses?
Well, because those probably also don't meet the hearsay exceptions, absent some evidence of excited utterance.
Let's transfer this statement to a crime report. This statement is made by a defendant. It's an admission against interest, and it's recorded in a crime report. Admissible or inadmissible?
Admissible.
Is a probation officer's report more reliable or less reliable than a police report?
It's more reliable, and I'd like to qualify my answer to the last question about the complaint report, because it depends on where that crime report, for what purpose it was used. Crime reports are often attached to complaints, and when the defendant pleads to the complaint, they often admit that the factual basis of the plea is contained in the report attached to the complaint. In that case, it would be part of the record of conviction. But a regular police report, particularly after a jury trial, that's usually not part of the record at all. So it depends on the usage. But at a complaint, where, as in this case, the defendant stipulated that the factual basis could be found in the reports, that would be it would be reliable, it would be part of the record of conviction, and it would be comparable to a colloquy in which the defendant assents to or agrees with the facts that the trial court has found.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCarroll. Your time is up. And we'll hear from Mr. Kresser by way of rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to go back to the whole statutory question, because I think it really provides the right decision for this court to make, which there is simply no statutory authorization to appeal. As I said, when we're trying to ascertain legislative intent, did the legislature ever intend that the prosecution could go to trial on a prior conviction allegation, the judge make a negative finding, and then the people could appeal that? And I think if you look at legal history and legislative history, you will find there's no evidence to support that.
Why is there no statutory authorization? We've referred somewhat cryptically to Section A-10, or rather Subdivision A-10 of Section 1238, the imposition of an unlawful sentence. But the rest of Sub 10 goes on to say, as used in this paragraph, unlawful sentence means the imposition of a sentence not authorized by law or the imposition of a sentence based upon an unlawful order of the court which strikes or otherwise modifies the effect of an enhancement or prior conviction. Now, why doesn't what the trial court did here fall within that definition of the term unlawful sentence?
Because, Your Honor, the striking or modifying the effect of an enhancement or prior conviction assumes that there has already been a positive finding on said enhancement or said prior conviction allegation. And I think if you really look at the whole statutory scheme as a whole, the legislature has said that people can appeal a dismissal where they never get to an adjudication on the merits. If they get their adjudication on the merits and they get a positive result, and then a judge does something to somehow avoid the sentencing consequences of that, then the people can appeal. But for that middle area of the actual adjudication, the trial of the prior conviction, I don't think there's any legislative intent to allow the people to say, oh, wait a minute, there was an error made here. We get a new trial on that.
Well, what if a judge says this doesn't qualify as a strike? Let's say, does that come in within your non-appealability argument? And the judge is just
yes.
Dead wrong. It's exactly what it says in the statute is a strike, and the judge says that's not a strike. It would seem the people have no remedy. Is that correct?
That's correct. But as this court has frequently observed, the rule is that the people, unless they have statutory authorization to appeal, may indeed suffer a wrong without a remedy. And that the mere existence of legal error does not give rise to an automatic right to appeal that the legislature has not authorized. And one thing I would like the court to carefully consider is the history of SB 1850, which amended Subdivision A-8, because that was the post-Monge attempt to get the people's right to appeal to the absolute limits of the Double Jeopardy Clause as it had just been construed by this court. And it would allow appeal from anything that had any effect on the substantial rights of the appeal. It would have allowed, reasoning, decisions, orders, this, that, and the other, a whole laundry list of things. But not one. And from that, the author's statement that we're going to allow prosecutorial appeal to the maximum thing, that has been quoted in later Court of Appeal case law. But what has not been noticed by these Court of Appeal decisions is that not one word of the original SB 1850 was ever enacted into law. And the opponents of that bill said, wait a minute, this is a vast expansion of the people's right to appeal sentences. And we don't believe that we should do that. In fact, their examples of what they want to do doesn't really correlate to this vast expansion of appellate rights that they are seeking. So let's just make a couple little technical tweaks to A1, A2, and A8, and I'll go home. And that's what the legislature did. And I think that's a very clear indication that the legislature never intended to go down the route and allow the people to come in and claim that error was committed in a trial of a prior conviction allegation. And again, historically speaking, did they authorize it when they adopted A-10 in 85? It was unknown in the law at that time. How could they have intended it? Never to happen, not once. And shortly, and actually while that bill was being considered, a court of appeal decision came up and said double jeopardy applies to the prior, the trial of prior conviction. So they would have had case law that would tell them it's not even constitutional to do it. So I don't think you can infer any type of intent from A10. And if you look at the history of the minor change that was made to A8 in 98, I think it's clear evidence of the legislative intent that we're not going to go whole hog on this and let the prosecution appeal these types of decisions. So I want to make that point clear. Going to the point that that you mentioned, Chief Justice, in some of your questions to the Deputy Attorney General, I think you put the finger on the distinction that the U.S. Supreme Court has drawn here, which is basically we're going to look at judicially established facts to define what the prior conviction was. Facts that were determined back then. We're not going to now make new factual determinations that weren't made then. And basically, in this particular case, that's what's happening. They're asking for a finding of weapons use that was never the subject of any positive finding by a jury, any positive finding by a judge, and therefore they say we'll look at your jury trial, and if the jury actually found the fact that makes it, we'll accept that, and if the judge and the defendant agrees in the plea colloquy that he did something, and we'll buy that, but we're not going to go on and start pawing through other parts of the record, post plea investigations. And again, the confusion of reliability of certain statements. Basically, what the prosecution wants is not just this evidence admitted, but they want this court to give conclusive effect and say to a trial judge, you've got to take that and find that that's true beyond a reasonable doubt if you have evidence like that. Well, that's a role this court has never undertaken, and it should not do so at this time. If there aren't any further questions, I would submit the matter.
Apparently none. Thank you, Mr. Gresser. Thank you, Mr. McCarroll. The matter stands submitted. We are on recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.